what I mean by investing in people to prevent social problems is to look at where we've been going as a society and which way we ought to be going in the future. So briefly, where are we now? America has always seen itself as one of, rightly so, as one of the richest, most developed, most modern, progressive countries in terms of providing education to its children, taking care of people's health, all of the whole range of social indicators. I think America has always prided itself as being a leader in the world. But in recent years, some areas we've gotten worse and other countries have surpassed us. Infant mortality is one such rating. Among Western developed countries, we're near the bottom in terms of infant mortality, meaning we've got a higher infant mortality rate than most of the others. That's generally a sign of health of pregnant women and how well we take care of children, how good our healthcare system is. It's not that we don't have good quality doctors, we probably have the best in the world, but nevertheless, access to them is not all there. And so our infant mortality rate is among the worst of the developed nations. Third world countries, we can leave them out because we'll certainly look better compared to them, but I don't think that's what we've been trying to compete against. Crime rates, I think we have the highest violent crime rate in the world. We lock up far more people than any other country until about 5 or 6 years ago. Soviet Union and South Africa were much higher than us in terms of percentage of the population we locked up. Soviet Union, as that fell apart and they released a whole lot of political prisoners, they fell below us. South Africa, as the changes have been there and they freed a lot of people from prison, they now are well below us. So we have both the highest crime rate in the world by far and the highest prison population. Education, as measured by the stuff that graduates know and by dropout rates and so on, we have been falling behind in many ways, and so there's a big movement out of education reform and what we're going to do to solve our problems in education. I'd suggest that what we need in order to address these things are a vision, and I don't think of a vision as a utopian vision because I don't think utopia is realistic. And I don't think we'll get there, but I think we can have a vision of a working, functioning society that meets basic human needs, that provides health care, provides quality education to all children, and continuing education to adults who need it or want it. Chemical dependency, education and treatment, recognizing that a certain percentage of the population, either to alcohol or other drugs, is very vulnerable or is addicted to them and needs help with it. Providing basic food, nutrition, affordable shelter, early intervention for families in crisis, early and ongoing education. I think all of these things are things that we need to have in a vision of where we want to be 10 years from now, 20 years from now. And when I suggested doing these things, providing prenatal care to pregnant women, providing non-nursing home housing options to senior citizens. If we do these things very well, I think we'll have a better society. Not a utopian one. Crime is not going to disappear, though I think many of these things can reduce crime. Child abuse or alcoholism will still exist, though they'll be less prevalent. The goal of a better society is not really what's controversial. I think every one of us here says, yeah, if I asked how many of you would support that, yeah, everybody raised their hands. It's a thing everybody wants, and we've always had as part of our American dream that the next generation, our kids, are going to live a better life than we live. We've often thought of that economically, but I think we think of it in terms of other ways, other indicators too. Things are going to be a little bit easier for them. They'll have better educational opportunities than we had. And I don't think there's a whole lot of controversy over the fact that it's not that way anymore, that the next generation economically probably won't be as well off in terms of crime and certain other social indicators is going to be worse off. Healthcare access, I don't remember it being a widespread occurrence in the neighborhoods. I grew up in middle-class neighborhoods. I don't remember that being an overwhelming concern, and I hear a whole lot of people who I think of as middle-class now can't afford healthcare. Retirement costs, their savings didn't cover what they didn't predict in terms of healthcare cost escalation. But while we all have this view we'd like world, the world to be better, we've all kind of come around to accepting the fact that it's not getting better, and it's getting worse, if anything, and talk of educating all young people, it becomes a little more distant. It's not quite the reality we thought it was. Guaranteeing healthcare access, at one time, 50 years ago, we talked about the whole planet. Every citizen of the world ought to have healthcare. We signed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights at the United Nations, saying all these things, promising all these things to every citizen of the world. And I'm not sure quite that there was ever a decision made at some point that we were going to stop working for this, but 20, 30 years ago we gave up. We thought, well, third world, yeah, it would be nice if we could take care of it, but we can't. And now we've gotten to the place where our own country, we say, well, we'd love to do this, but we can't afford to. Ending poverty and hunger, well, that's unrealistic. We can't afford to take care of that problem. Or we talk about we'd like to do it, but you know, times are tough and government has to cut its budgets. Minnesota, the state I'm from, has been traditionally seen as a leader in tackling these problems. And I think those of you who aren't from Minnesota often see Minnesota as, at least there used to be a reputation, 20 years ago Minnesota made the cover of Time magazine as kind of a can-do state that was tackling problems. But let me suggest that Minnesota is doing the same thing the rest of the country is, and that is deciding we can't face these problems, we can't tackle them, and we back off from them. I've been in the legislature for 7 sessions now, and every year we've done some combination of tax increases and budget cuts. Every year, all 7 of them, we've cut budgets. Not total dollar amounts, but what some would say is to cut the growth in them. But if you look at the school funding, the amount of money per student, because there are more students, we may cut the amount available to any one student because there are more students, though the budget goes up. Nursing home budgets keep going up. Well, part of that is, even if you leave the same dollar amount per person in a nursing home, there are just more people in nursing homes. So the cuts may be cuts in the growth, but it's the cuts in the growth of the quality, too. It's not because there are more people needing a certain service, we may cut the amount available to anyone. So it is a real cut in service to somebody. It is a growth in budget over 5 years ago or so. But last year we had a, I don't know how many $100 million budget shortfall, and we cut from, among other programs, what we have is a state chemical dependency treatment program. Fewer and fewer health care plans cover people's chemical dependency needs, and therefore the state had this program that was put in place 20 years ago to help provide chemical dependency treatment. The most common being alcoholism. Far and away, most people who get chemical dependency treatment are addicted to alcohol, not to illicit drugs, but it does cover others too. Well, last year, because the state was in budget troubles, we tightened up the qualifications again for who qualifies for the chemical dependency program, and we cut $4 million from it. And we could say, yeah, we're fully funding the program, everybody who qualifies for it gets it. But if you look at what it takes to qualify, you can't be earning minimum wage. You earn $2.20 an hour. You're making too much money in order to qualify for the program. So it covers very few people, and we keep tightening it up further so fewer and fewer people get covered from it, and we cut the program. That did save us $4 million, and we did balance the budget, which we're required to do every year. And that's a good thing to do, to balance the budget, since you have to, and it's a wise way to run a government anyway. But it didn't do anything about chemical dependency. $4 million worth of treatments disappeared, and the people who had the chemical dependency didn't all of a sudden get better. Most of them continue to get worse. It means more dysfunction in families. Alcoholism does not cause child abuse or cause domestic violence, but it does have a connection to it. People who are alcoholic tend to be more violent, more aggressive when they're alcoholic, when they're intoxicated. And there are other problems that have very clear links to societal costs and taxpayer costs. DWI, because of a person who didn't get treatment, can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxpayer money, even if we don't lock up the person for a long period of time, in terms of court costs, medical care costs that the state picks up for the people who were injured or killed. One DWI fatality may cost far more than it would cost to treat 100, 200 people with chemical dependency. And yet we cut this program for it, and we feel good about it because we helped make the budget meet things. Then another example of how I'd suggest Minnesota, like other states, is backing off of these things. Minnesota, 2 or 3 years ago, decided to establish a program called Minnesota Milestones, which was to measure, set goals for the states and measure our progress toward them. And I think that was an admirable project. I think everybody ought to measure their effectiveness at whatever they do. Businesses traditionally do it. It's something government doesn't always do, and this was a good one. But in this one, I was reading through the goals last year. They had task forces traveling around the state and getting public input on what the goals should be. And the one that struck me most was one on childhood poverty. We're now like 16-18% of our kids are in poverty in Minnesota, which we probably point to as far better than the rest of the country. And the goal was knock it down from 16-18% down to 12% in 5 or 6 years. In 10-15 years, we were going to hope to get it down to, I think it was 5%. And that's where we're going to freeze it. You know, if we get down to 5%, we're doing pretty good. That means only 1 in 20 kids is living in poverty. We're making a goal, an ultimate goal as a state in Minnesota, to say that if we do everything right, if we meet this goal, which we didn't set out a plan on how to accomplish, but if we meet the goal, every school classroom is going to have somewhere between 1 and 2 kids living in poverty. Somehow that doesn't seem to be a goal. It seems to be a surrender to a problem. We certainly have political problems in every same way every state does. We have partisan disputes between Democrats and Republicans, as every state does. Somebody asked me earlier why I was running for governor. Our governor this year, and I don't mean to pick on him because the last governor of my party didn't do any better, but there's one time in the past year that I remember him expressing extreme outrage and taking what I would call bold, decisive action to address that problem. And that was after a Minnesota Gopher basketball game, which there was poor officiating, apparently. I didn't see the game. The governor took the time, he had a news conference, next thing he announced, he was writing a letter of angry disgust to NCAA to criticize the officiating. And, you know, I'm a basketball fan too, and I can understand how people get outraged at bad officiating. It does happen. But for the governor of a state to take the time to write a letter to officials, that was the one time this year I saw him get outraged. You know, we've got kids who go to school in Minnesota who go to school hungry at the end of the month. Their parents living in poverty qualify for food stamps, and the budget runs out at the end of the month. They go to school hungry. Now, I think that's something we ought to be outraged about at some point. Not that we all have the answers of how we're going to do something about it. And maybe the solution we find isn't always the best one, but I mean, I don't know that his letter to the NCAA was taking care of that problem either. But at least to show some outrage at something that's unfair or unjust in society. And I'd suggest that not only this governor, but our previous one of the other party, virtually every state has the same kind of problems, usually worse than Minnesota, and nobody expresses any kind of outrage. We've kind of settled in, and that's the best things can be. We got to live with it. Can we do better? That's what I think we can do, and I can't prove it. I can't show that things are going to get better, and I don't think we'll know unless we try to do so. But let me start out with the best known program nationally in terms of how I think we can address problems. That's the Head Start program, early childhood program for kids who qualify because they're low income and they're high risk of not succeeding. It's not a perfect program, and in recent years they've had more and more troubles because standards have been falling and they're not as aggressively making sure things are done right for the kids who qualify. And sometimes they cut corners so they can get more kids in the program and less available to any one kid in the program. But I've heard people of both political parties, every end of the political spectrum, saying what a good program Head Start is. Matter of fact, most politicians will take pictures of themselves at Head Start centers playing with little kids. I had one in my brochure last time. I mean, it's a good thing to do. Everybody likes Head Start program. And I'm not ashamed to be affiliated with it. I'm proud to be affiliated with supporting the program. Everyone from Jesse Jackson to Ronald Reagan says the program actually saves us money. How does it save us money? We don't know exactly how much. I've heard numbers as high as $7 for every $1 we invest in it. I would guess it's probably not that high. But and there are questions how long of an impact it has, though there have been some studies from Michigan that suggest that 20 years later, kids who went in Head Start have a slightly higher, not much higher, but a slightly higher chance of succeeding in life, getting jobs, not being involved in poverty, not being on welfare, all the things that we consider somebody successful in society, contributing member of society rather than a problem for society. The indicators are better if you take a kid who's been through Head Start with a control group kid who would have qualified for Head Start but didn't get the program. Yet even though everybody in the political process says what a great program it is, and it saves us money and to boot, nevertheless we fund less than half the need for the program. And need is currently defined. There are a whole lot of people who could qualify but don't, and because we tighten the standards up there. I'd like to suggest, and hence the topic title, that we ought to be investing in people to solve problems. And the people who we probably could make the best buy off of in investing in people is young children. And if we ought to invest in the programs, if it makes sense to have any Head Start program, and if it saves money, then instead of funding it for one-third to one-half of the kids who qualify, why not fund it for everyone who qualifies? Is that a liberal, conservative idea? I don't know how we measure things in the process. I've often wondered why something is called liberal or conservative. It doesn't always make sense to me in that way, so I try and suggest that, as any business person knows, you look for good investments, and you buy stock heavily in those things. The things that make sense to do, you go all out for. If something's kind of questionable, you shy away from it a little bit more. If you see you're going to lose money off it, you really back off of it. But when we have everyone from Ronald Reagan to Jesse Jackson saying this program saves money, and yet we don't fund it, you got to question, where's the common sense in that? Why don't we do better than that? I proposed a bill last year. It didn't get anywhere. But I think it was a bold step in the direction of what I think we need to be doing in terms of investing. And I took some new money. I proposed a tax increase on higher income people. Why did I pick higher income people? Frankly, the bank robber, what was his name, Willie Sutton, somebody asked him why he robbed banks, and said, that's where the money is. And if you look at disparities between various income groups in recent years, rich have been getting richer, poor have been getting poorer. And the top Forbes magazine has, for since 1982, run a feature called 400 Wealthiest Americans. And in the period from 1982 till 1989, which I think was the most recent number, this is the most recent number I've seen. They may have a newer one since then. But the top 400 Americans, their net wealth jumped from, and these are rough estimates, you have to understand, people who have a lot of money don't generally tell everybody how much they're worth. But Forbes magazine, making their best estimate, was that those 400 richest people had a net worth in 1982 of $92 billion. That jumped in 1989 to $270 billion, literally a threefold increase. Their income tripled in that period of time, whereas the net income of most Americans stagnated, to say the least. It fell proportional to inflation, and inflation was not 300%. It did fall, and therefore, taking a relatively small tax increase on high-income people, I raised in Minnesota terms, and the national level, it's a joke because it's much bigger numbers, and bigger states like California and New York and so on, these numbers sound very small, but $600 million it raised over the next two-year period. And then I went and I picked out, I think it was like 15 programs that there's pretty strong, at least common sense, that you're going to be saving money by investing in these things. and suggested, why don't we fully fund these? Not pick out 30 programs, 50 programs or something, but I picked through, tried to pick out the ones that I thought had the best chance of saving money for the state and made good sense to me as just humane things to do for people. Took one, it was a California pilot program on chemical dependency and mental health screening. A couple of counties in California had taken juveniles who had been in trouble with the law and who were in detention, actually locked up in what we might call a jail or a prison, though we don't call them those for young kids. And they said what they were going to do with those kids is give them treatment. They were going to screen them all. Do you have any problems with chemical dependency? Do you have any problems with mental health? Surprising number of kids who are in trouble with the law do have troubles with this. I don't know, maybe that shouldn't be surprising. Why are they in trouble with the law? Maybe because they have some problems we have to address. So we ought to address those problems and screen them. Find out, does this kid who's just been arrested for not shoplifting, we're talking about rape or violent crimes generally, crimes are serious enough that they lock them up for them. And screen them, and if they need some help, you give them treatment. You make sure they get it. You don't just refer them to a program, and if their mom and dad don't send them to the program, then they miss out. But you actually make sure the kid gets into the program, shows up at the program, participates in the program. And they found out it actually did something to reduce crime. Surprise of surprises. So I thought that was a great idea. Why don't we try it in Minnesota? So I was chairing our crime committee in the Senate a couple years ago, and I tried to get that included as part of a crime bill. I actually succeeded a little bit. I wanted a statewide program for both chemical dependency and mental health. I wasn't going to try for all juvenile offenders, just those who were locked up, the serious ones. Unfortunately, I did win, I suppose you could call it a win. It ended up being a pilot project for 4 counties, and we skipped the chemical dependency. So if kids got problems with alcohol or drugs, well, great idea, but even for this little pilot project, we can't afford that, so we'll take care of mental health needs. If we could find kids in these 4 counties who were in trouble, we'd scramble around, make sure they all get screened for mental health needs, and if they were assessed to be in trouble with that, we'd make sure they got some help. Good thing to do, but now I have a feeling people are going to look back 2 years later, look, we tried this program, and there's still a lot of crime around. But we only tried it in 4 counties, and only tried one of the 2 things. But I suggested this year and in this bill, I provided full funding for statewide chemical dependency and mental health screening, not just for the juvenile offenders who are locked up, but every kid. I mean, you shoplift, you probably may be less likely to have serious problems, but I'll guess a certain percentage of them are going to. You steal a car, you don't get locked up for stealing a car if you're an adult in most states. It's too common and you can't afford to lock everybody up, so auto theft, you just write them off. But we're going to take every one of them, make sure they get the help they need in this. Early childhood education is another good one. Head Start's the most prevalent, best known of the programs. Minnesota has a program that we put in place and never funded to provide it to kids who weren't qualified for Head Start. Just because my kid isn't economically at risk, why shouldn't my kid have the same opportunity, since it makes such a big difference to give kids a head start? Why don't they get the same kind of head start? Minnesota has a program like that, plus some nationally known early childhood family education programs in which the parents and the kids, like Head Start, go there. They give the parents some separate training while the kids are in the program for 2 hours once a week or so. The Women, Infant, Children Nutrition Program, the WIC program, saves $3 for every dollar we invest in it. Again, there's some pretty good evidence of that. Why does it save money to spend money on milk and eggs and protein for kids and their pregnant moms? Well, you take care of a pregnant mom and kid is less likely to be a low birth weight baby. Why do we worry about low birth rate babies? Well, nowadays they survive. Baby born 2 months prematurely may not have lived 25 years ago. Nowadays, they do live. It costs a lot of money, though. It may cost neonatal intensive care unit can cost $200,000 for one kid. Can go more than that if there's serious problems. And that's just the short term, after they get out of the hospital. If they need special education because they have some birth defects, maybe have some mental retardation or something, you may be paying hundreds of thousands of dollars throughout their educational career to get them there. Well, the WIC program provided some help in getting people to health clinics. It also made sure that they got the nutrition they need. Health care for all kids. Minnesota's got a new health care reform program, which is widely touted by its authors as being the step that the national government should take next. And I wouldn't say it's that great of a thing, but it's certainly better than most other states have done. But if we provided that, made it available to all kids, so that anyone who couldn't afford health care on their own could get it, in addition to making sure kids grow up healthy, I think what that would do for welfare, getting people off of welfare. If I'm a single parent and I got two kids and I want to get off of welfare, I got to try and find a job first of all, and chances are I'm not going to find a $20 an hour job. I may find better than minimum wage, but chances are it's going to be $6, $7, $8, $9 an hour at best in Minnesota. And out of that, I got to pay for child care, unless I'm going to let my kids run free all the time when they're not in school. And so I need to pay for child care, and I need for health insurance. And if I can't afford health insurance off of a $6.50 an hour job, well, then you got to question, am I smart? Which makes more sense, for me to stay on welfare where my kids get health care, or to go to work and where they don't get health care? I frankly think they ought to get health care, and if a parent decides I'm not going to work because of that, I can't really blame them too much. It may mean they love their kids. And why not provide health care to all kids, in which case then that takes away that disincentive for getting people to work. We can expect a lot more out of people if they're not going to lose their health care for trying to find a job. Affordable child care fits in with this. Last year, everybody remembers the parents in Chicago who left their kids behind, went on vacation, made national news. Everybody thought, oh boy, we got a big problem. Two of my colleagues decided we were going to do something about that big problem in Minnesota. They introduced a bill to make it a crime to leave your kids at home alone. Then they had to draw the line somewhere. Where is the crime going to be? They don't want to be unreasonable. They picked kids 10 and under. You can't leave them at home for more than 24 hours at a time without supervision. And we're going to solve that home alone problem in Minnesota. But the reason it made national news was because it was kind of rare. Parents who leave for 2 weeks to Mexico and leave their kids behind, I don't think they were like an 11-year-old kid and a 6-year-old kid or something. Leaving your kids alone at that kind of age, it is pretty outrageous. And glad it made national attention and so on. But that's not what the problem is. There are thousands of kids in Minnesota, and I'll guess in every other state, kindergartners, who go to school in the morning and they come home and there's nobody at home. Why not? Mom or dad or both, if they have two parents, are working. And there's nobody who can pay for the child care. Well, that's a good way to get in trouble. Maybe a 10, 12, 13-year-old is going to be home alone, and I'm not that comfortable with that, but it's a lot less of a problem than 5- and 6-year-old kids. But we could provide health, we could provide child care and health care for kids, and we would do the best, that would be the best single thing we could do to get people off of welfare. Take care of the two biggest expenses that they have to have. And frankly, if we're going to save money, we got to get people working. Got to get people off of welfare, off of dependency, and into their own jobs. So we take care of the two biggest stumbling blocks to them. I suggested that those things actually may save us money. I couldn't prove it. I don't have any statistics like we do with some programs that they're going to save money. I think it will. And if not, it's certainly a wise thing to do. And the long term, and I'm not talking 2-3 years from now, but the long term of 10 or 15 years from now, I think we're going to do a whole lot better to make sure kids are raised in a healthy way. There's a bumper sticker I know I've seen in our state, and I think other states too. If you think education is expensive, try ignorance. Well, there's a lot of truth to that, and if you look at, if we want to look at who you want to be raising, working in your factories in the future, and working at post office in the future, and working everywhere else in the future, I'd sure rather have kids who grew up healthy, who didn't end up moving 4 or 5 times during a school year, being bounced from school to school, or kids who didn't have the health care they needed, or kids who were left at home when they were 4 or 5 years old because their parents were working. I think in the long run, all these things are pretty clearly going to save us money, though, again, as I said, I have no statistics to back that up. One other one I wanted to mention briefly, family planning. that becomes controversial all of a sudden because, oh, you're making birth control available to people. And certainly Catholic community has opposed family planning, other than natural family planning in the past. Why does this save money? Well, if one out of every six kids in Minnesota, one out of every five kids in the country is in poverty, most of them on AFDC. What you have to calculate is how many of those who can't afford birth control or don't afford it because it means less money for other things. We can question whether they spend their money wisely or not, but the fact is they don't have birth control, they don't use it. If we make birth control services available to low-income people in every county in the state, what you have to calculate is, supposing they have the same ratio of people who can't afford birth control on AFDC as the rest of the population, one out of six in Minnesota, how many births do you have to provide to fully fund this $12 million program? Not a lot. AFDC is not a cheap program. And while some of it's paid for generously by the federal government, more than half of it's picked up by the state. So we pump money into AFDC from 14, 15, 18-year-old moms who don't have a chance at supporting themselves at this time. They weren't supporting themselves now, and then they have a kid they're going to take care of. Well, that kid puts them on AFDC, and we all end up paying for it. I think a lot of these things make sense to do in and of themselves. So where do the funds come from, real quickly? I have certain cuts in existing programs I'd like to see happen, plus increased efficiencies I think we can do. I think there are lots of creative things that are being tried in various places that we ought to pick up on. One of the best ones I've seen is a for-profit corporation started, I think, in New York, in which the guy and his wife started a business in which they will take people on welfare and put them into jobs. And they charge the state of New York, and a couple other states have been working with them too, after they've successfully placed them. And not successfully placed them for 2 days and then the person quits, but in which they actually have them work for 6 months. And if they're still working there after 6 months, they get their payment. This business is doing a booming business because they know how to get people to work. And they provide the help they need. A lot of people, if they a government program to do the same thing may not work because, okay, we're going to give you the training you need, we're going to do this, and then we're going to put you to work here, and all of a sudden, good, you're on your own now, and the next day they have a sick kid, and the kid can't go to daycare, and the person can't show up for work. And well, this firm has had a very high success rate. When they contract with New York and other states, they agree to take anybody who wants to participate in the program. And they make it hard. I mean, they do things right, and they do it well. I think we can make some increased efficiencies that way. And as I said, I think we can cut some existing programs. But I don't think we can kid people and say we're going to solve all our problems by making cuts in government. A lot of the cuts we do are things like that chemical dependency program I mentioned earlier, which actually make things worse. Most of the painless easy cuts have been made a long time ago. A lot of the ones that I think would still make sense to do, two things. One, in terms of the whole scheme of things, they don't save millions of dollars. They may save a few hundred thousand dollars here or there, which makes them very worth doing, but it's not going to fund the programs you need. And when you look at the total dollars that you could get, even if you could get the political will to make some of the cuts you'd have to do, it ends up being small potatoes compared to what you need. I liken it to what one of my neighbors did when I was growing up. I remember an old man down the block. He was 80-some years old. And I remember he had decided we had to solve our federal deficit problems. This was 74, 75. And so he wrote President Ford and suggested this wonderful new program in which every American family should contribute $1 to help reduce the federal deficit. Federal deficit then was about an eighth or a tenth of what it is now. I mean, at least it was less than $1 trillion, and now it's going on $4 trillion. I'll guess it was well under $1 trillion, but so it was a fifth or sixth of what it is now. But if every American family put in a dollar, I mean, we're not in the same ballpark. $1 per American family would not make a big dent in a whole lot of things. If you look at how much government spends more than it takes in now at the federal level, The federal government is spending, I think it's about $1,600 for every person more than it's taking in taxes nowadays per year. $1,000 more. I think it's more like $1,000 per person. Let's see, there are 250 million people in the country and there are deficits of 250 billion ballpark. $1,000 per person. So unless my neighbor was thinking $1 per family, not per person, and we would wipe out this deficit. And we're not, he was talking about the debt, the $4 trillion now debt, when what we should have been talking about was more realistically eliminating the deficit for this year. Maybe give your $1 per year, but he's off by a thousandfold right there. And so the same thing with a lot of these cuts. We're not going to get the money you need to do some of these things. And a lot of politicians promise, both parties. I talk about how I'm going to try and save money through budget cuts. Everybody does. And, you know, if everybody's out there making all these wonderful cuts and doing all these things, how come it doesn't get solved? And that's partly because the amount of money there needed to do some of these things isn't out there. So why can't we just slash things? Well, partly because we've been cutting. Why is government budgets growing so fast then? And that gets me back to the whole point. Government budgets have grown in Minnesota and every state and the national level have grown far faster than inflation for 20, 30 years every year. If inflation is 3%, budgets are going at 6%, twice as fast as inflation. Why? Is it because government now just throws money down rat holes that it never did in the past? And yeah, it does throw some money down rat holes now, and those are the things we ought to try and clean up. But it did that 20, 30 years ago, too. It wasn't perfectly efficient then. The biggest reason government spending is going up is because we're failing to address these very problems. Crime rate goes up. We put more people in prison. That doesn't solve crime. We keep creating more and more criminals and locking more and more up. Minnesota and every state has locked up about three times as many people as we did 18 years ago. Do we have a lower crime rate? No. We have a higher crime rate. And we don't have much choice. Once you have a violent rapist out there, you don't, either you're going to have them do it again and again and again, or you lock them up for a long period of time. And that's where you pay the money. We're spending the money on prisons. We're spending the money on health care that we didn't prevent. We're spending the money on welfare because we didn't get people properly into jobs. We're spending money because we failed to address the problems up front. And unless we step in, get ahead of these things, and start trying to prevent problems, 10 years from now we're going to have higher budget deficits and more spending than we have now. And it's kind of frightening when you look at what kind of shape we're in. If you take the national deficit, bring it down to a family budget, if your family budget is about $36,000, which I think was the average income last year in the nation, about $36,000 was average median income. And if you want to figure out how much of that we're using just to pay the interest on the national debt now, $2,800 is what we pay just to pay off the interest on the national debt there. And how much is the national debt? National debt would be, in that family's terms of income, if your income is $36,000, the national debt would be about $180,000. About four or five times your total annual income would be your share of the national debt. And of course you can't pay that off, so we have to start not just holding down the deficit, which means some increased taxes, but also preventing the problem so they're not worse 10 years from now. Real quickly, there's some other things I'd like to talk about, but I think it'd be better to open this type of topic up for discussion. Is this politically doable? Well, I gotta say, I don't think we'd know unless we try it. Certainly, any talk about tax increases or more spending, no matter how wonderful the program is a big red flag with people. A big, big, big red flag. The last politician I remember who talked about increasing taxes was 1984, Walter Mondale said he was going to raise taxes, and boy, did that disappear. He backed off of that right away, and his campaign went down in flames, up in flames anyway. But if you leave people the options of spelling out, how about if we spend more money on these things that are going to save money, keep working hard to cut things elsewhere, but and don't promise any kind of panacea, and you do it in a fair taxation system, recognizing that a whole lot of people are going to lose their house if they have to pay more taxes on it. A lot of people, if you tax them more, it means they can't afford medicine, or they can't afford health care, they can't afford food. You can't tax certain people anymore. Even if you wanted to, there's no more money there to get. And higher income people, they've been the most politically visible. They're the ones who get tax breaks in the first place. So they don't like this either. But I'm convinced that most of the public still holds the dream that they once held, that life is going to be better, if not just for their kids, but for all of the next generation. Life will be better, and that we're a society that believes in making progress. And I think if you look at it in the last 20, 30 years, we've really, as a society, have given up our hope. And I don't think the public wants that. And somebody asked me while I was running for governor, I think that's one of the types of things I'd like to prove that we can do. I think a society shouldn't be surrendering its problems and doesn't have to. And whether this works, I'll guarantee you one thing, and that is what we're trying now is not working. It's going the wrong direction. So with that, I'll be quiet. And we've got at least 15 minutes for questions, discussion, or challenge, things like that. Yes?
Question. I believe in Wisconsin, didn't they limit the payments on aid to dependent children to one child, the first child, or the first two children, or something like that? Does that work, and is it working?
Wisconsin, I don't think they had done that. I think that's been proposed in a number of states. Wisconsin had one where if a person wouldn't, if kids wouldn't go to school or something, they couldn't qualify for certain things. Maybe Wisconsin had that where you limited to the number of kids. That may or may not work. I mean, if a woman didn't want kids in the first place, you got to look at why did they have a kid if they didn't want a kid? Well, was it lack of family planning? If so, you've got to address that need. You got to make sure they have family planning available. They know how to use it. They use it. So they stopped having more kids. Cutting their AFTC benefits, there are certainly some people who I'd love to have a baby. I mean, that's a growing problem now. More and more teenage kids who don't have, perhaps because they don't have enough love and affection at home, they want to be loved and cared for and needed by somebody, so they want to have a baby. And when you do that, you've got real problems. But saying you're going to cut AFTC, even to somebody like that who wants to have kids, well, who are you punishing, the mom or the baby? The mom or the dad, for that matter, though the dad may not be involved. Who are you punishing? It tends to be the kid. And especially in early years, kids who don't get their needs met are the kids who are most likely to, later on in life, be the biggest problems for teachers. When we look at soaring educational costs, when you have special ed kids with one or two kids per teacher, which you have to do unless you're going to throw them in with the general population all day long and let them disrupt everybody's education. If you think it's expensive to have a student-teacher ratio of 20 to 1, think how expensive it is to have a 3-to-1 type of thing that a lot of special education programs have. And so I'm not convinced that cutting AFTC benefits to somebody stops them from having kids, because either they wanted the kids in the first place and they're going to want them anyway and the kids are going to be the ones who suffer, or if they didn't want the kids, we've got to look at why they didn't want them. And you also bring in the whole abortion debate here. If you're saying, well, some people are going to say you're encouraging more abortions by telling people, look, no matter if you're pregnant or not, you got to do it. We have to address the need of unwanted pregnancies and making sure that teenagers don't want to have kids. I mean, I think that's a real serious problem in society now, and it wasn't there 10 years ago. I think most kids who got pregnant did it by accident, not by choice, and more are deciding by choice. So I don't know that that's going to solve our problems. I think we have to look at what we can do to make sure parents aren't calculating, as some probably are, that I'll get this much more benefit for having another kid. I sure wouldn't want to try and raise my kids on the AFTC allowance, even in Minnesota, which is higher than most states. Yes?
In our town, we have a prison. Greatest mistake we ever made. In that prison, just recently, they put in 650 color TVs. They're all on cable. How many of you have steak once a week? They do out there. And their life is so scheduled that people are in there for a while, they get out, and they cannot adjust. And they do something to get back in because it's easier, and it's a big...
Life is, in some prisons, life is easier than a lot of people. I mean, for me, I mean, prison was supposed to be an undesirable place. And frankly, if you have a door slammed behind you in prison, people who have been there tell me it's a horrendous thing. But you know, the television thing, I keep thinking, you know, why do we want... Television gives me bad ideas to people who aren't in prison. Why do we want it for people who are in prison? I think if the best thing we could do for our kids would be destroy all the television sets. And that's not saying that there aren't some good things on television. It's just saying that on balance, there's a whole lot of bad things that I don't think kids ought to be seeing. And in terms of that, yes, one of the reasons prisons turn to things like cable TV and color televisions are because it's easier to manage people when they can sit in a box and do that, and you don't have as much chance of riots and that sort of thing. And prison riots become very expensive because prison guards, Minnesota had a big push a few years ago to have double bunking, they call it. We put two people in a cell, which violates court orders. Courts will step in if they feel you're doing things that are too dangerous or cruel or unusual punishment. The guards also have a fit if you start putting too many people in a place because you're making it much higher risk for riots. And Minnesota brags about how we haven't had any prison riots in umpteen years, and the liability cost for what you pay the guards. If a guard is killed or something, you can do a whole lot of nice things in prisons, but it seems to me we should be focusing much more on more programming dollars for prisons, trying to get people jobs in prisons, making sure they're working, making sure they're getting treatment. All those things are actually more expensive than putting in more television, so we do in Minnesota is the same kind of thing. I don't know that they have cable television, but they put any inmate that wants can have a television set. They have to pay for their own, but they all get television sets, and I think we should keep people busy in productive ways, but prison industries would be a great thing to help us accomplish a lot more things in society. As soon as prisons try and make anything other than license plates, why do they make license plates? Because there's no competition. Minnesota had a prison industries program where they started making these great road tar boxes in which they bring tar out for patching potholes, which is a big Minnesota problem. And these things were selling real good. Other states were buying them. Cities and counties and states all around the country were buying these great things. Well, other companies who made similar types of things started getting offended at that because it was taking away their business. I don't blame them for being mad at it, but prison administrators have a real tough job, and I agree with you. A lot of people, if you're living in bad circumstances, you know, life's taken care of for you. And I don't think prisons...
Prison is no punishment.
Yeah, it's not punishment. Well, in some ways it is a punishment, but in some ways some people, it is comfortable for them. They're taken care of. They don't have to worry about what they're going to do next. They may stay out of trouble more there. Of course, they may also learn from other bad apples what else they can do wrong. I'm convinced we have to do most of our crime stuff before crimes are ever committed, and that means working with young kids. Why do we have more rapists now? It's not because we're softer on them. I mean, 15 years ago, prison terms for rapists in most states were 8 months, a year, year and a half at most for violent rape. Now most states are beginning to realize this is a serious violent crime, and it's taken a long time, but we lock people up routinely for 10, 15, 20 years in a lot of states now for that thing, and yet the rape rate is going up. Why? It's not because genetically we're producing more rapists somehow, or there's some rays from outer space coming in and affecting people's minds. It's because you look at television, you look at how we treat women as a society, you look at how this gang in California that was sexually having contests to see who could have sex with the most women. What kind of a society, what does that teach kids? We've got so many things that we have to address, and television isn't part of it, but prisons put televisions in because it's cheaper than keeping people busy. Yes?
You say it should go where the money is, you don't get to rob a bank.
Yeah.
So let's go get the rich. But people say that in terms of the federal deficit, where the money is the entitlements. And anybody who wants to cut it has to have the political courage to do that. Now, neither Democrats nor Republicans want to do that. Whether it be Social Security, Medicaid, any of these, they just avoid that with a 10-foot pole. How about you?
Okay.
Would you have the political courage?
Sure. With those things, let me suggest in terms of a lot of entitlements, some of them are some of the things that I'm saying we ought to increase. Well, they tend not to be entitlements, because if they were entitlements, Head Start's not an entitlement program. I think it ought to be. I mean, I think every kid ought to be able to get Head Start. Just they're entitled to as a citizen. I think healthcare ought to be an entitlement. Medicare, not Medicaid, Medicare and Social Security, I don't see a whole lot of reason that we shouldn't be taking people who are higher levels and doing it. I don't want to see somebody who's living on Social Security their only income. I don't want to see that cut. I don't want to see that cut, but I do. So in other words, I'm willing to cut the entitlements, but for the people who can afford to. If I'm making $180,000 a year in pension income, I don't need Social Security. And there are people who do that. There are a lot of people who do that. In Minnesota, and this kind of surprised me because I spent a lot of time on demographic types of data and so on, the top 1% of Minnesota households in income starts at about $280,000 a year. That's much per year in income. I looked on my neighborhood street, and we're an upper middle class neighborhood. I can't picture 1% making more than $280,000 a year. The average of that top 1% is over $750,000 a year. $750,000 is the average of the top 1%. They don't need those entitlement programs. Frankly, people making $80,000-$90,000 a year may not need Social Security benefits.
That's what I'm asking.
And that's where
it down to.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what line you'd do, but it seems to me you got to go below the wealthy. You have to go into the upper middle class and maybe down the middle class. And the trouble with
that's
that,
what the money is.
There's a lot of money there.
That's what the money is, right?
That's right.
Lots of money.
And
because that's 1% versus like 20, 30%.
It may not be 20-30%, but it's a significant percent. And the point is, we have to, AARP and certain groups like that, rightfully look out for their own interests.
Yeah.
But there's a big difference between what we as a society ought to be looking out for. And I'd say there are a whole lot of seniors who, poverty among seniors has not been eliminated, though it's been greatly reduced, partly because senior groups are gaining more clout. It's good they're gaining clout when it helps the people who need the help, but in terms of the others who really don't need it, we've got an interesting phenomenon. When Social Security was put in place, 65 was kind of the dying age. Your life expectancy was about that. You retire, you qualify for Social Security, and you die. And it wasn't meant to be a cruel thing. It was meant that if you were going to live beyond the age you were expected to work towards, you'd have your income needs met. Well, what we have now, we have 62 and can take early retirement. And we have people who retire in Minnesota and other places at age 55. Great. I mean, fine if people want to retire at age 55. But life expectancy now may be closer to 80 years old. And so we've got to recognize you've got from age 55 to 80, and you're going to be 25-year vacation. Fine if we can afford that as a society, but I'm not sure we can right now. And the way we should be doing it is, first of all, recognizing there are a lot of people in that age group who want to and ought to be able to work, and maybe they don't want to keep their same job and so on. But we have not done a good job in some of those entitlement programs in sorting out who needs it and who doesn't need it. And you've got a good point there. In terms of those two programs happen to be federal programs, so it's not, I mean, I can say, hey, yeah, I think I think you're right. I don't have to make those decisions, and I don't get stomped on, but it's really important to do, because that's the kinds of places, those are the entitlements where they do cost a lot of money. And there is some potential for making some big savings there. The Social Security is supposed to be off budget, and it's supposed to be a trust fund, not a program where we raise taxes and pay for benefits. It's supposed to be you're entitled to it because you did that. And it's also a regressive tax, because if you earn more than, what is it now, 50-some thousand a year, you're paying the maximum already, so you earn $2 million a year, you're not paying any more in Social Security taxes than somebody who's making $50,000 a year. A couple more questions quickly, and then we'll...
I think psychologically, though, it'd be better to pay, have people who make over $180,000 pay a higher tax rate than to take Social Security away. Because they pay for Social Security.
But the point is, however you do it, and I think that's a good point, because it is a trust fund, you don't want people who do it to start thinking, I paid into that, I deserve it. And if they start taking away from those people, next they're coming to get it from me, and next they're coming to get it from you. But you can accomplish the same thing, effectively taxing over a certain percentage. You have 100% tax on Social Security. I mean, you could do the same thing, and you could avoid the downside, the psychological downside.
No, not tax Social Security, tax their entire income.
Their entire income.
Yeah.
Well, I don't disagree with it. We used to, in 1960, we had a top tax rate of 91%.
Yeah.
Maybe that was too high. Now we have a top tax rate of 31%, and how many people don't pay that who are making much money? But you make a good point about, I'm in favor of progressive taxes. I've offered a number of bills to do that at the state level as much as we can do. In the federal level, you can do much more because you don't have the competition between states.
Yeah.
But a couple more quick ones, and I'm happy to talk with people after this, but we'll have to cut out.
A couple years ago, the chaplain for Charles Manson was here at Fulton, and he presented sessions, and they were titled The Crime of Punishment. Anyway, I remember two statistics from his presentations. One is that the second biggest budget in America, second only to the defense budget, is the penal system in California, and the second biggest in the whole country. And the other statistic I remember was that he said that probably only 5% of the guys and gals in prison need to be locked up. 95%, he said, could be elsewhere. My point in those two statistics is to ask you a question. Is there any problem, you can use that one specifically if you want to, that politicians address with creativity, other than just looking at the status quo and somehow trying to deal with how to shift a little bit in the status quo, as opposed to something really radical or visionary, like this guy might have suggested for prisons?
Yeah. Very, very seldom is there the great creative thing. I mean, we do creative management things, but in terms of the political spectrum of where ideas come from, and we can say, oh, that's the fringe left or the fringe right, but nevertheless, if the spectrum is this wide, most political ideas in the real honest-to-goodness debate we have are in this narrow of a range, and we don't look at things like that. I'm not sure it's only 5% of the people in prison need to be in prison, but everybody, again, this is federal level again, drug crime.